Hi, Ken here. In nearly all of our podcasts, you hear students asking questions and their interaction with me. Many listeners find these exchanges illuminating because what is being asked is often exactly what is on their minds. If you find these conversations helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can maintain and expand our website. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, A Trackless Path, Part 4.
August 22nd, AM. So, any questions, practical points you want to touch on?
Is it important to conclude a session resting in the experience of the breath, as you do, say, with doing the four immeasurables? And if so, why?
Yeah, it's better to just leave it on. When you're working on, there are really two different kinds of practices here. One way that I break practices down into different kinds are practices which are primarily the practice of presence. There are practices which you can call purification in the sense that you're working on something. And then there's energy transformation practices, which the purpose is to transform energy into higher states to power attention. Now, primary practice is the first and third. Four immeasurables are the second and third. So, because the intention in the primary practice is to come into as completely as possible the experience of what is happening or what is arising right now. It's good actually just to continue that practice into one's experience, and I'll say a word or two more about that in a minute. When you're working with something like the four immeasurables, and it could be death and impermanence or any number of other practices, you're bringing attention to the operation of patterns. So a lot of stuff is getting churned up and moved around. And for that reason, it's usually better to have a period at the end of the practice where you allow all of that stuff to resolve itself. And hence, resting with the breath or resting in open awareness at the end of the measurables, or that kind of practice, is better. Now, going back to primary practice and the relation of the formal meditation with what we're doing the rest of the day. One way to view formal practice, where you're sitting and devoting that time to practice, is that you're cultivating attention or forming a relationship with awareness or presence unmixed with other activities. When we get up and have breakfast and wash and take care of the things that hold life together, this is an opportunity to cultivate attention or form relationship awareness mixed with activities. So one actually makes the same kind of effort, though most people find it more difficult to bring the same quality of attention mixing it with activity in the beginning, but it's very definitely something to to work at, and it's best done by working at it with simple activities such as walking. And so you can walk with the same sense as the primary practice. Now, one of the tendencies we inherit from much of Buddhist teaching is the sense there is something to work towards. Certain experiences, certain states of mind which we are meant to achieve. You follow? Yeah, I'm not. I think this actually is quite problematic. And at least for the duration of this retreat, as much as possible, I'd like you to just let go of that notion completely. Not working towards anything, but through our efforts and practice, learning both the skills and developing the capacity to live, and we could say experience life, because I want to put those, make those almost synonymous, a different way. And that's something that's going to evolve through our efforts. It's not at all clear to me that it evolves the same way in every person. And through the course of our time here together, you're going to sense where imbalances are in your ability to be present in your experience. And that's something we'll discuss in interviews and so forth, but that's where the next effort and practice is going to be. And it may mean adaptation of a particular method that you're working with, or it may mean bringing in something a little different, or maybe completely different. Does this make sense?
Very much. Very helpful.
Okay. Claudia.
Did you put the primary practice as an energy transformation practice? Is that the category you put in?
It partakes of both practice of presence and an energy transformation.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Saved by the bell. Do you have another question? Okay. Purification. You'll find these in chapter 2 of Wake Up to Your Life. Okay. Breakfast time. Okay. So it's August 22nd in Mandala Center, New Mexico. Evening discussion. I received a note requesting that I follow up on the discussion we started yesterday evening around this verse in Longchenpa's 30 pieces of advice, about which I translated as don't be close or opposed to anyone, maintain your independence. That's my sincere advice. I was not able to find the Tibetan text online. I sent a request to a friend who may get it to me sometime in the next 24 hours. He's pretty good at digging this stuff up, but he's not sure that he can find it. I've checked another translation which has a somewhat different reading. But I think a more fruitful direction, rather than narrowing down on that particular passage when we don't have the source text available, would be to engage a broader and possibly deeper matter. And that is, how do you live in a way that supports your spiritual practice? And there are many, many aspects to this, and there are also all kinds of advice and teaching on it. And a lot of the advice and teaching some of it seems to be directed at certain populations. I made the suggestion that Longchenpa is writing as a monk, and within the context of Tibetan culture, in which a monk of his stature would naturally be regarded as an elder and would be called upon to adjudicate disputes and sort things out within the village or town which he was close to, and that has been a traditional function of clergy in all traditions throughout the ages. Elsewhere he says, you know, just stay out of that stuff completely. in the same thing, he goes even further, saying you may think you're helping people, but you're just getting caught up in stuff. And then there are other forms of advice that we receive, that if you do this, you will experience being born in the hell realms for infinite numbers of lives in the future, so it's not a good idea to do this. And there's all the promises of painful or pleasant consequences if you do such and such an action. And we find this in other traditions as well. I mean, I remember reading in some texts that when you act this way, the Buddhas are pleased. So there are many, many different forms of advice, and I want to say different levels at which this advice operates. And I think this is part of something we need to keep in mind. When we act on the basis of that we're going to be rewarded and punished for our actions, if that's how we approach them, we're really bringing the mentality of a child to our life. That's how what happens in the family. There's a certain reward punishment in many, many families anyway. And there's an authority figure who determines whether you've done good or bad, and there's possibly the same figure as someone else who determines what the punishment or reward is, and then there's a person who executes it. And I remember reading, I think it was Shostakovich, on the fundamental concepts of, Buddhism. It's a very short book. But he noted there were five functions that needed to be addressed in any spiritual system. You need to have the account for the creation of the world, creation of this experience, a source of being, the moral authority, and basically this breaks down to, into law, the judge, who is the authority, the prosecutor, who brings the case against you, and the executioner, who carries out whatever the moral decision is. And there are many, many religious traditions, spiritual traditions, which take that approach. And I found it—I found it rather odd, because when you're highly trained in a certain skill, and you run into a situation which requires the employment of those skills, you don't regard it as a matter of right or wrong, or of some moral issue in the sense of conforming to an authority. What I'm thinking of here is if you're a doctor, say, and you come across a person who is injured or has a disease, you heal them, or you do what you can to treat them. And it's because it's the appropriate response, given that you have those skills. And this is a very different way of functioning in the world, compared to doing things because they are deemed right or wrong or good or bad. And in our discussion yesterday, and from what I gather on the Ning site, people are looking at that particular line. Longchenpa says, don't be close or opposed to anyone, as is this the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do? And some people may be approaching it that way. Because many people are very caught up in behaving the right way. I think the deeper consideration is, how do we live our lives in a way that supports, and I would say both supports and gives expression to our understanding or the qualities that we cultivate in practice and are important to us. And a very important element here, I think, is the element of balance. I was faced with this myself when I was writing Wake Up to Your Life, and I had this one chapter which is very problematic, chapter 5 on karma. And up to this point I'd carved out a certain amount of time, but I continue to see students individually while I was in the process of writing the rest of the book. But I was really stuck on this chapter for a number of different reasons. So I decided to follow the advice of many, many writers and not see anybody and just really focus my attention on this. It was a complete disaster. I went nuts. I didn't get anything written either. And I realized from that that while that may work for a lot of other people, it certainly didn't work for me. That having contact with people, discussion of their practice and so forth, and that kind of exchange was actually very important in terms of having a balanced state of mind so I could think and write clearly. So I went back to seeing students, a few, and did get that chapter. Well, actually, what I did was I took off for 3 days and went skiing in 3 days of a blizzard, which made me even in a worse mood, so I really came back. Then I saw students. That's what I just had. That way just didn't work for me. And so, because we inherit a very rich tradition, we inherit all kinds of advice and guidance. And it's a little bit like going into a supermarket and trying to figure out which kind of shampoo you're going to buy. So there are very deep and very general principles. There are ways of approaching life which people in the past have found helpful and supportive or definitely non-conducive. And then there are very specific anywhere from recommendations and guidelines to instructions or moral imperatives. So there's a whole spectrum there. I mean, just as a very deep and very large-scale principles, there's the very famous quotation, I think it's from the Dhammapada, but I can't remember. My teacher quoted it all the time. Cease to do evil, learn to do good, tame your mind. These are the Buddha's teachings. Now, that's very, very deep principles. It's actually pretty easy to write a commentary on those three, which embrace the what in the Tibetan tradition we refer to as the Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana. The Hinayana is about adopting a way of life which avoids doing evil. The Mahayana is about adopting a way of life which does good. And the Vajrayana is about adopting a way of life in which you tame your mind. And it's a very, very big picture, but it can be broken down and applied in each of those contexts also. In the second category, principles by which people have found to be helpful, then we have things such as the 30 pieces of sincere advice. There's another very famous one by Patril Rinpoche, Virtuous in the Beginning, the Middle, and the End, which has been translated into English several times. There's other ones. There's Padmapa Sangye's advice to people in the village that he hung out all the time, and that's from the 11th or 12th century. And we also have in the support booklet here the 37 practices of a bodhisattva, which are worded as injunctions. But I think are better understood as principles. And then you get down to things like the seven points of mind training, which give you very specific things like don't lash out, don't rely on a sense of duty, and don't make a demon out of a god, and so forth. Very, very specific. And then you come down to moral codes, the two most fundamental in Buddhism probably are the five vows, or the core of the vows associated with the monastic tradition, which are not to kill a human being, not to lie about your spiritual attainments, not to steal anything of value, for monks and nuns, not to have sexual intercourse. For lay people, it's to be chaste, not to commit adultery, etc., and not to take intoxicants. That's one. And then the other one, the ten non-virtuous actions, not to kill, not to steal, not to have inappropriate sexual relationships, not to lie, not to use speak harshly of others, not to slander, or sorry, not to use harsh language, not to slander, not to gossip, and then not to covet, harbor ill will, or be skeptical. Wrong views, but I like to translate it as skeptical. If one approaches these as absolutes, you get tied up in knots pretty quickly. If, however, you approach them as ways to create the conditions in your life so that you can deepen your experience of life, then they work very, very differently. Some people, the way that they practice most effectively and can open to completely to their experience is to be in complete solitude. So you'll find that they write texts about, you know, live at least two bow shots from any village. Don't speak to anybody unless you absolutely have to, and so forth. But for whatever reason, that particular approach to spiritual practice is one that no one here has chosen. Yet, says Claudia. I don't mean to be impertinent, but I'm not going to hold my breath. I'm not going to hold my breath. For better or worse, we have chosen to live in the world, adopting neither a hermits, or I suppose the anchorites, approach, nor a monastic approach, where you live in a secluded community, or you adopt a way of life in which there are very specific guidelines and rules of behavior. And I would say, I would venture, that the reason none of us have done that is because that is not how we actually want to live our life. Nevertheless, we cannot practice effectively unless we engage in some sort of exclusion and inclusion. And people often say to me, I don't have time to practice. Okay? That's not true, of course. It would be truer to say, I don't want to exclude certain things from my life. And what I usually say to people who present that the time issue is, if you wish to develop a practice, it has to be one of the two or three top priorities in your life. After eating and sleeping. And if you approach it that way, that it is just something you're going to do, then you will find that the rest of your life forms and organizes itself around that. But if you try to squeeze it into your life, then other things will inevitably squeeze it out. So, practice takes time, and the time that we put into practice means that we aren't going to be doing other things. Those other things may be watching television, or playing video games, or surfing the internet, or and I'm using purpose quite intentionally at this point, activities which may not be that important, but there may also be things that which are important to us. And here the effort is initially not to decide what we're going to include or exclude, but to become clear about what is actually important to us in our life. When we're clear about that, the things rearrange themselves quite naturally. There may be some effort in making some adjustments, yes. But by being clear about what's important to us. Now, there are different ways of approaching that. Some people, they can just say, okay, this is important, this is important, this is important. But not all of us are that, think that way or that clear-minded. Another way is to observe where we put our energy. And that tells us, in very real terms, what's important to us, where we put our energies. And that can be a very interesting exercise, because we may, when we actually take note of where we put our energies in life, be somewhat disgusted with ourselves. I did a workshop, I guess it was a couple of years ago, on money and value. And I thought it was a fairly straightforward workshop. My first hint that it wasn't was during the lunch break, one of my younger students was sitting like this with her head in her hand saying, and I thought this was going to be a light day. But I really got the idea that it wasn't a particularly easy workshop, because I had four people the following week coming to see me, all of them in tears about what they had come across in the workshop. One of the exercises that I had them do was to draw up a list of priorities according to their spiritual values, and then put beside that what they were actually doing with their time, or how they were actually approaching things, a spiritual approach or a conventional social approach. And when they saw this, they saw that where they had thought of themselves as having a vibrant spiritual practice and so forth, they were quite disturbed to see that it actually rated about 2 or 3% of their lives in most cases, and that was very upsetting to them. This kind of honesty with ourselves, it's hard. It's hard because until we bring this kind of attention to our lives, we are often unaware of how much stuff is just running on complete automatic, whether it's family conditioning, social conditioning, cultural conditioning, just the ordinary routines of our lives. We just really aren't aware of it. And as we, as we become aware of it, I want to go back to this theme of balance. As we bring attention to the totality of our lives, all aspects of it, it's been my experience that people quite naturally are able to sense or sometimes see very clearly where the imbalances are. And often it's a relatively short step to the emotional agendas or the patterns that are driving those imbalances. And then a decision has to be made. Is one going to move in the direction of balance, or going to continue with the imbalances? When I say a decision has to be made, that's true. And it isn't necessarily one's going to make drastic changes right away. And here we come to one of the innocuous but really very important teachings in mind training, learned the three difficulties or the three challenges, whatever word you wish to use there. The first challenge is to recognize an imbalance. The second challenge is to develop a way of addressing it, a component of one's practice, if you wish. And the third challenge is to work at that method consistently. Things don't change overnight. Few cases they do, but I'm reminded of one of the Hollywood moguls who said, give me a couple of years and I'll make an overnight success of her. And that's often what it's like. They start working at something and then a year, 2 years, 5 years later, everything changes. But it has only come about through that consistency of effort. So, bringing this back to the verse which inspired this whole direction. What, when it comes to how we interact with people, what are the ways of interacting with people that actually work for you? Now, I didn't bring Shakespeare with me. I have a feeling I should carry Shakespeare around. But you may recall in Hamlet, Polonius gives Laertes a bunch of very good advice. Neither a borrower nor a lender be, etc. And even though Polonius is often played as a kind of stuffy old man, the advice that he gives his son is actually really solid advice about how to live in a balanced way, so that you have friends but you're not taken advantage of and you don't take advantage of people, etc., etc., etc. My own experience with this, and this probably is just a testament to my stupidity, is that I only learn these things by actually tasting how they don't work. I can see something written or somebody can say something, and I'll say, yeah, that sounds really good. Makes a lot of sense. But with me, I have to encounter a situation in which it really becomes alive. Then I'm much more likely to live by that principle. But if it is a mere concept or an instruction or something like that, it doesn't come alive for me. Anybody else like this? I'm not sure that everybody's like that. Some people seem to be more sensible. But very closely connected with that is because I make a lot of mistakes. And as I said last night, the key thing is not whether one makes mistakes, but whether one learns from them. So if you do something and you learn from it, no big problem. I mean, it may be a problem, but if you do the same thing three times and you still don't learn from it, now you have a really big problem. So the things I want to go from here. One of the ways that I've come to approach it, and I suppose this is always in the back of my mind because I gave the tagline of Pragmatic Buddhism to Unfettered Mind, is this is primarily about skill in living. Now, there's some interesting things that go along with that. Number one, do you want to be skilled in living? Now, the answer for me for that is yes, because when I'm skilled in living, everybody suffers less. Not just me, but everybody else too. And then there are learning the skills, and as I said, I find that for me there's a lot of experimentation. And then the third aspect, and I've touched on this before, is that one finds that in order to live skillfully, one actually has to have a certain capacity, or certain capacities. One has to be able to endure without getting bent out of shape. Tension or even conflict in different parts of our personality. One has to have a capacity for patience. Attention, of course, so forth. Through all of this, and I made mention of this right at the beginning of this retreat, I really don't think there is one right way. And that's why I was quite happy when George suggested the title for this retreat be A Trackless Path. Thought that was basically right on. What we're working at here is for each of us our path in life, and each of us has come here with past experience which some of which weighs on us, and weighs sufficiently that we don't want to live that way going forward. And we have the sense or the wish that, or the, maybe not just the sense, but also the experience that taking the time to develop the capacity and skills to be completely, as completely present in our experience as we're able to, is a way of creating the kind of path in our life or the way of living that we seek. So I've talked for a little while here. Questions? Is any of this helpful? That was a resounding yes. I like that.
Develop a way of addressing it and work it consistently.
That painful, eh?
Well, I guess I just don't quite know what you're pointing to with that. I mean, it seems like every imbalance will potentially have a different way of addressing it. I think you're talking about a method or an approach or something.
Well, that's a very general principle. Suppose that you come to see that you never give anything to anybody. And you know, you're not a generous person. So that's the first challenge. Recognize that. A way of addressing that might be, and I've used this one myself, to give something, no matter how inconsequential, to somebody once a day. It could be a paperclip or a piece of paper. But to make a point of actually physically or giving a physical object so that it's transferred from one hand, from my possession, my physical possession, to another's. Very tangible. And then you just do that consistently. That's the third part. And you find that when you do that, things begin to change. But that would be one example.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't pick that as an example of an imbalance. I would pick that as an example of a pattern that, I mean, something's underlying, there's a reason, there's something underneath why we're not giving, and that's one way of working with that pattern.
Yes, because when you do that, it's going to bring you in touch with all of that material.
Exactly.
Yes. So I don't think we're really saying different things here, because one of the characteristics of reactive patterns is they create imbalances.
Yes, that's true, but it is my experience that that those patterns create imbalances at a point in our life, and we can be faced with the residue of that for many years, and addressing that imbalance many years later can be quite difficult, especially if it involves people, which it almost always does.
Yes.
And the pattern that created that imbalance may have already been worked with, or you're already aware that that pattern set this in motion. But do you understand what I'm saying here?
I think so. Let me play it back to you and see if... Okay. At some point in one's life, for whatever reason, adopted a certain mode of behavior, maybe it was emotional reaction, something. And it created... it got you through certain situations, but it created a bunch of problems. And you come to recognize that this is not such a helpful way to relate to things. So you go to work on the emotional pattern, and you become clear about it. And so it actually doesn't operate. But meanwhile, the imbalances that have been set up have continued to propagate in one's life, and one feels totally trapped in the mesh.
Very good. Very well put. That's exactly what I'm pointing to.
What's the problem?
The problem is correcting those imbalances can deeply affect the other beings that are involved.
Ah.
And potentially create pain for them or suffering.
Well, I'd like to change the vocabulary a little bit. Life has taken on a certain structure. And the structure may or may not work for you at this point, but it works for a number of people that you're close to. Something like that?
Exactly.
I'm so glad I'm understanding you. Well, I think there's only one person who can decide what to do in those circumstances. And I think there's only one way you can decide.
Which is?
How can I die with the least regret? Now, that may sound very selfish, but it isn't really, because when we bring death into the picture, remarkably quickly, it ceases to be about us. And it becomes about our whole life and everybody in it. In other words, when we bring death into the picture, we naturally move into or open to everything. And it clarifies an awful lot of stuff. Now, most people don't like doing that because what is tugging at them, and I'm not saying this in your case, but in many cases, is some quite personal agendas, which are causing them, and this goes back to inclusion and exclusion, to exclude different aspects of their life, different aspects of their experience, and to to focus on just a couple. But when we bring death into the picture, it cuts through that kind of editing. And really brings attention in many, I think, to the relationships which are important to us. And I mean relationships in a very broad sense. In a discussion with someone earlier today, it came up Buddha's renunciation, where I had a wife and child and was groomed to be the next king, or really just local chieftain of a particular principality in northern India. And he walked away from it. Now, if you're the wife or child, that doesn't matter what the reasons are, it just doesn't feel very good. But I suspect, I don't know of course, but I suspect that for Siddhartha at that point, his questions about life were so compelling that that was the only course that he could proceed. Now, historically we look back and all kinds of good has come out of that, and as religions go, Buddhism isn't too bad. It's not been the cause of too many wars. But still, started with the abandonment of a wife and child. Well, you know, and this is, of course, in the monastic community, this is praised. This is one of the great deeds. 12 great deeds of Buddha is that he abandoned his wife and child. And
it's true in Christianity too.
Okay.
Jesus told his followers,
to
walk away.
Right. So, the reason I bring this up is, get away from the idea of right and wrong. I would couple with that with, don't be narcissistic in one's life. But we're going to encounter choices, decisions, And we won't know what the consequences of them are. And we'll have to make a choice. And that's one of the better ways that I've found, is to bring in the matter of death at that point. I think Christy also had a comment she wanted to make.
I haven't formulated my fully, so
I was just going to comment that I mean, I've been in that place of facing death.
Yes.
And I didn't choose to resolve the imbalances. In fact, I took more of it on.
And at the time, how was that for you?
I felt like I was doing what I had to do to take care of all the other people. And it was the right thing to do.
Right. And now?
I can't believe I did that.
Things change, don't they?
I mean, I can just see the pattern that created that, but... yeah, things change, and I think things get more difficult when you're operating out of a pattern. You're an autopilot. You just do it. When you're not, and there's some sense of clarity about what's really at hand or at risk here. I think that process becomes more challenging.
More challenging in the sense that there are more possibilities, or more challenging in the sense it requires greater courage?
Probably both, but the one that's sticking at me is the courage.
Thank you. Christy?
Well, I'm still muddy with my thoughts here, so... All right, blurt it out.
Blurt it out.
Okay.
See what we... You know, I didn't do too badly understanding Claudia, so... maybe.
So in all of these reflections and trying to decide what to do about things, there's something in you or something that trusts or knows... And one of my questions has to do with what knows, what vows. I don't know whether it should be who knows or who vows, but in any event, whatever.
Is the second one vows?
Vows.
Who promises?
Right.
Yeah, okay.
All the bodhisattva vows.
Right, right.
All those
okay,
other
who
vows,
makes.
The
who
marriage
makes,
vow, all
yeah.
those vows.
Who takes on the vow?
Right.
Yeah.
What's doing the vowing?
For a muddied question, that was very clear. Well, that question is the basis for most of Buddhist philosophy. And it arises this way. In order for a monk to break his vows, He has to know what he is doing. So there's a huge amount of energy was spent in exploring and trying to establish the conditions in which there was a valid cognizer, to use the clumsy English translation. The conditions in which there was a valid cognizer. Fortunately or unfortunately, I'm totally unequipped to engage that question at any depth because I haven't studied any of that stuff. I take a rather different approach. Who knows? Who vows? I think these are quite different questions, these two. I had an email from, I presume, a fairly young person, I would say in his 20s, maybe older, I don't know, he lives in another part of the country completely, but it reminded me of many things that I experienced, and I was in India and starting studies of Buddhism. For many people, took ordination with a great deal of sincerity and found themselves completely unable to live it. And sometimes they just stepped out of it, and sometimes it was quite messy and quite traumatic. And this person is describing a similar situation. So it continues to this day. When we were talking about vows, we're talking about intention. Wendell Berry wrote a very nice piece on relationship. And the crux of it is, when you give your word, you enter a mystery. When you make a commitment, you enter a mystery. You have no idea what is going to come up, or what you're going to have to meet. So I think the an important piece, something I think is very much overlooked, is when you take a vow, you must be willing to enter a mystery. Many years ago, probably a good 15 or 16 years ago, I found myself in a situation which I really struggled with. And what came out of that was an appreciation of an aspect of the Bodhisattva vow that I had never considered and I can't recall having ever seen written about, though it must be there in some form or another somewhere. And that was that when you take the Bodhisattva vow, one aspect of it is that it's a vow never to indulge your own confusion. Indulge your own confusion. And Bodhisattva vow is a vow that is always, from the time that I first heard about it, always meant something quite special to me. What I found over the years is that it cuts deeper and deeper the longer you work with it. And it's very much reflected in this adaptation of the four vows from the Zen tradition that I put in our opening meditation sessions. When it starts off with beings are numberless, may I free them all. Well, this is usually how it's worded in the Tibetan tradition anyway. But what I've come to appreciate is that that's actually mythical expression, where beings are a way of talking about everything you experience. Because the next line is about reactions, and the reason that beings are a problem is that they elicit reactions in us. So that's why reactions are endless. And you have to deal with every one of them. You can't indulge any of them from the Bodhisattva vow. You can't indulge your confusion. Then it goes a step deeper. Because all of you know from your experience that when you are actually present in a in the experience of a reaction, it releases and something opens. Something that you couldn't see or couldn't experience before. There's an opening, it's a door to experience. So now the question is, are you going to take every opportunity or not? Let's see, it gets heavier and heavier. And every one of those openings becomes a way of awakening, which you can use time and time again. So, how the Bodhisattva vow deepens is very clearly expressed in these four lines. One second. So, that I think is the important thing. And it may be that one part of you made the vow, but now the rest of you has to live with it. Unless you find yourself so out of balance, as people do, that you may have to change the relationship with the vow. And for some people, making a commitment and living it is a path of practice. Now, Valerie has a question, then I'm going to come back to the who knows part. Valerie?
I just can't quite wrap my mind around, what does indulge your confusion mean? Does that mean let it direct you? Or I'm not sure what indulge means.
You come into a situation. You know what the right thing to do is, but you don't want to do it. So, do you live your clarity or do you indulge your confusion? You have all sorts of reasons why you shouldn't do it, but you know that they're all bullshit. Sorry,
but you said, I guess I'm just quibbling with semantics. If I were confused, I wouldn't know what the right thing to do was in the first place. You said I knew what the right thing to do was, but I didn't do it.
Okay, then I'll take a step further back. You come into a situation. You're not sure what to do. Do you make the effort to become clear? Or do you just do something?
So that sounds more like indulging confusion. Thank
okay.
you.
Yeah. Comment? Mary. Oh, yeah,
I think an old expression for this is getting on your high horse.
Well, that's certainly one way, yeah. So the question, who knows? Well, you could do this. You can use this question in practice. You could also use the question, who vows? But that takes it in a very different direction from what I was just talking about. Let's take the question, who knows? So you're holding a pad of paper, right? Who knows that you're holding a fat pad of paper? Now, when you ask that question of yourself, what happens? So it's a bit like Mulla Nasruddin. Mulla Nasruddin was invited, a friend. I wanted to get together and talk, so he went over to the friend's house. They got so engrossed in their conversation that neither of them noticed that it had gotten dark. And they were continuing their conversation in the dark. Eventually his friend said, Nasruddin, it's dark, light a candle, and you'll find a candle and matches in the drawer by your right hand. What? Said Nasruddin. How do you expect me to tell my right from the left in the dark?
I have a tone deafness when it comes to Nasruddin's stories. Sometimes they ring and sometimes they don't.
Well,
but
can you tell your right and left from each other in the dark?
Yes.
How? Who knows?
body has a wisdom. Well, right and left is an arbitrary designation, but...
Both of those exits didn't work very well, did they? How do you know?
This isn't going to answer the question. This may confuse things even more. But have you read A Beautiful Mind, the story about John Nash?
I'm familiar with the story. I haven't read the book or seen the movie. I've seen parts of the movie. But.
Okay. The very first page of the book, there's this scene where he's a schizophrenic, and he's in at that point in his life, and he won a Nobel Prize for math. He's sitting in his chair, kind of all slumped over, and another mathematician professor is visiting him, and says to him, "How could you have believed that aliens were telling you to do? How could you believe that?" And Nash's immediate response was, "Because it came from the same place where he got his understanding of experimental truths, experimental proofs." And when I read that, that's part of my struggle with the understanding of who knows. It's both, when I think about me holding the paper, it's an opportunity to have that kind of gestalt shift of the I not being there, and everything is there, and nothing's there. But these are really, for me, tricky places, because I wonder then how rapidly I might jump to some kind of interpretation or magical thinking, or as you try to absorb the experience, well, I get lost.
Ah, thank you. It's a question of capacity, then, not understanding. Very important. So, you know how to tell your right from left in the dark, right?
I think so.
It's probably quite difficult to explain how that knowing works. Would you agree?
Yes.
What would it be like to live from that knowing?
say that again?
What would it be like to live from that knowing? This knowing which you experience vividly and clearly, but can't explain.
Well, it sort of feels like falling through the universe.
Yes. Is that a problem?
Only if you need to get across the street with the traffic coming.
Really? I would think this knowing might function quite well in those circumstances. No? Where would it be a problem? Hold the mic up, please.
If there's more than you that's in the knowing or in the experience, but then you're going to tell me you can't have a shared experience.
Well, I could go that route, but so you're saying when there's another person involved?
Yes.
Valerie sitting beside you, right?
Yes.
What's the problem?
I'm not talking to Valerie.
Pardon?
I said I'm not talking to Valerie.
Okay, you're talking to me. What's the problem? There is that knowing, isn't there? It's just there. The reason I say it's a matter of capacity is that for many people, probably for most, it's very difficult to rest in that knowing for more than a second or two. But when you rest in it, even for a second or two, how do you experience things? Right there. Isn't that what you're looking for? You see, the function of such questions as who knows is not to engender a school of philosophy, though it's done that far too many times in the course of history. It's to bring you into that experience of just knowing. It's one of many, many ways. And having tasted it, you then cultivate the ability to rest there. And eventually to function from there. Now it costs a little bit. How aware of you, how aware are you of I when you're in that knowing? Then it becomes very vivid, yes. But in the knowing itself, no. So that's one of the prices. There are others. The story is told of an Ananda. This is the Zen version, not the Theravadan. Zen always changes things a little bit. Ananda had this phonographic record. He had listened to Buddha's teachings and had knew every word and every occasion and who was present, etc. So when anybody was trying to figure out what Buddha said about something, they go to Ananda and say, what did Buddha say about this? And he said, that's what I've heard at such and such a place with such and such, and then Buddha was off to the next sutra. After Buddha died, the core disciples were going to meet together in the first council to decide what was the Buddha's teachings. This is something the chief disciples always do. It's a very bad thing, but that's another matter. And Ananda came to the gate. Kasyapa said, no, you can't come in. You haven't woken up yet. I mean, we're very grateful for you knowing all of the Buddha's teachings, but you haven't experienced any awakening, so you can't come in. And Ananda was crestfallen. How can you do this? There's nothing he could do, so he walked away. As he was walking away, Kasyapa said, Ananda! And Ananda went, yes, and woke up. Right in the knowing. Okay? So, do you know how to come into the knowing?
Set up an opportunity for it to happen, and sometimes it happens, and sometimes it doesn't happen. Sometimes it happens all on its own.
Right. You have a way that usually leads you there.
Not reliably.
Okay. Primary practice is one such way. And you can extend that by anytime you're experiencing something, looking at something, you can ask, what's looking? What's experiencing this? Don't try to answer that question. But when you ask, you'll experience a shift. Rest in the shift. when you do walking meditation. Who's walking? This is a fairly reliable way, as long as you don't try to answer the question, because that just produces thinking. There's a shift, and you rest in the shift. Because when we ask this question, there's a looking. So you rest in the looking. And as you gain facility, you'll find that you can also look in the resting.
I'm sorry, you find that you can also look...
Look in the resting. That's how you practice. Initially, you do it for short periods of time, you know, anywhere from 2 to 5 seconds. And as you gain facility and build capacity, you'll find you'll be able to do it for longer. Microphone, please.
Yet in the Zen tradition, for example, and the story you gave of Ananda, there was a permanent shift.
Well, this goes back to...
I mean, at least that's what's inferred here.
This goes back to what I was saying earlier about the Hollywood mogul. Give me a couple of years and I'll make an overnight success of her. So, you work at this. It builds capacity, builds familiarity, and it creates the conditions in which something can shift. And then you experience, then something changes in the system. You can't bring about that change just by saying, by turning a switch.
But the soil needs to be prepared.
Yeah.
Yet there's all of the discussion that's gone on for a long time in terms of sudden versus gradual.
Well, yeah, there's sudden and there's gradual and there's unstable and there's all of this. We have a third one in the Tibetan tradition. I'm always reminded of Nisho Kempo, who is a Nyingma teacher that I studied a little bit with. He would say, some people say when you hold your fingers, thumbs in meditation, there should be just enough space to slide a piece of paper through, and other people say that they should just touch. What I understand from this is that people will argue about anything. Okay, so some people, the way that their path unfolds is gradually. Other people experience sudden shifts, quite dramatic shifts. Like they wake up and the whole way the world, they experience the world is different, and it never changes. What people then seek to do is to explain so that all of these things can be fitted into a system so that people can feel comfortable with it. That's all those explanations and debates serve, is trying to make people comfortable so they aren't dealing with a mystery. And for me, as far as I'm concerned, they're completely pointless. I mean, I can give a very nice explanation in terms of fractals if you wish, but so what? You have no idea whether you are going to be gradual or sudden awakening one. It's all just, you know, taxonomy. And really quite irrelevant. It may not be irrelevant to a teacher who is seeking to guide, but to a student it's completely irrelevant, because you just have what you have in front of you, and how do you be with that? You know, when you're in a teaching position, having familiarity with the range of possibilities helps you recognize and maybe provide more accurate or appropriate guidance. So it's somewhat useful there. But it's 90% of it's just stuff. Okay. What time? 8:34. Okay. Anything else you'd like to discuss this evening? Valerie. You're very bad at hiding questions.
Pardon me?
You're very bad at hiding questions.
You ought to play poker with me sometime.
Never.
I'm
worse.
You'll win.
I see, when there's money on the table, you become very good at it, do you?
No. I notice I have an urge to bring the discussion into around as to where we began. And I keep finding myself asking, you know, you started out with Longchenpa, and how do we build our life so that we can do what's important to us? We end with the discussion of awareness, how to look for it, where to find it. And in the middle of this was the discussion with Claudia. And, of course, what Christy said about the problem being when there's someone else in your awareness.
Is this going back to Sartre now?
Well, we can. I think it's probably too big of a question to even start at 9:30 or 8:35 at night. But for instance, I found myself asking, "Well, who experiences this? Why wasn't that why wasn't that the answer to Claudia's question?" In some ways, bringing death into the picture makes that question happen. But I guess I'm finding myself wondering, you know, we've talked about walking in awareness, mixing awareness with activity. How do we mix relating with other human beings?
How do we mix awareness
with
relating?
How do we mix up ourselves with other human beings? Well, that's not what I was trying to ask. But to me, this is really challenging.
Yeah, it's very good. So, you do the dishes after dinner. Clean up, right? Several people working simultaneously. How much talking is going on?
Well, with this crew, very little.
How do you know what to do?
It's pretty clear how dishes are washed.
Sure.
And I know I've done thousands of them already in my life.
But some people are washing dishes, some people are wiping tables, some people are putting things away, some people are doing this. All these different people doing different things. But it all works out somehow, doesn't it?
Yes.
How does that happen?
As I said, it's a relatively simple task.
Yeah, well, maybe it's a simple task, but that doesn't answer how it happens.
I have no idea how it happens, Ken. I think,
but it does happen, doesn't it?
And I think driving in traffic is like a miracle. How does that happen? How do we all hurtle through space and not die all the time?
Well, yeah. So it happens. That knowing is active, isn't it?
But I think of all the conflict in my life over who does the dishes. Why am I always doing the dishes?
Well, we'll get to that in a minute. But it happens. And you might explore that a little bit. People are present with each other, doing all of these different tasks. One person starts to go to wipe a table, another person moves, starts wiping the table, and okay, the job is being done, so the other person now moves off to do something else. No words are said, but there's coordinated activity, and what needs to get done gets done, and nobody says a word. Now, I'm not disputing, it's a relatively simple matter. There are a limited number of tasks, a limited number of people, and relatively short duration, etc. But one of the things that I'm going to propose here is that there is a sensing or a knowing that is taking place all the time. If everybody tried to wash the dishes, it would be a big mess, right? So when somebody's washing dishes, that's taken care of and effort goes somewhere else. So there's a balancing and rebalancing going on constantly. And this goes back to my discussion with Claudia. So, how come you end up washing the dishes all the time?
Because I'm not living at a retreat, and let's say it's not clear to everyone that doing the dishes is an important task, and it's some people feel it's more important to watch video games or listen to something else, or
and you're not prepared to pay the price for changing the balance.
Well, thus comes the muck. So
yes. So now it is more complex, and there's a lot of other things in play that aren't in this situation, but I was using the situation as an illustration of possibility. You can bring the same kind of knowing into your life. It will produce changes. You may not be able to predict all of the changes. You enter a mystery.
I enter a mystery and I become a critical, what do they call it, martinet.
You don't have to do that.
I know, but I think it really comes, it's really what Claudia was talking about also.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on, a lot to take into consideration.
You're quite right.
And the sacrifice versus endurance versus, I mean, there's just so many things going on, so.
Yes,
start with the dishes.
And this may seem completely impractical, but I found it useful and I think it can work. Open to everything, not just that situation, but everything all the time. It's one of the reasons we practice this way. So you understand or know the interconnection and feel it. Then you'll move away from the notion of sacrifice. You'll feel far more natural. We'll continue with this tomorrow. Okay? And think about it in the meantime. Okay. No arrivals yet? Okay.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.